this episode is going to be a little bit raw because as I was going through the audio tapes and reviewing everything Art Smith talked about on his deathbed, I kept going back and thinking, gosh, this must mean something more. What did he actually mean by that? What is he trying to tell us? In the last episode, we covered the first half of the first visit, August 14th, 2023. Art Smith, in this second half you're going to hear, does an almost Freudian slip, in my opinion, a reveal of sorts. It's information that was never on the news, and you're going to hear Sue's reaction to it. It feels like she's been almost punched in the gut. You'll hear her lead him at certain points and hear him lead her. It's a dance, but the emotion emanating from Sue to me is palpable. And Gina, Art's niece, but also so much more than that, a fighter for justice, is also joining me in this episode because she was there. She heard his words in person, heard Sue's reaction, and knows her late uncle all too well.
I didn't hear it from Joey, so I don't know if that there was an altercation at the rectory on Friday with Bishop Gross, and I use that term loosely. Butch Mazur.
So he nodded a little bit. Do you remember that argument that she's referring to, that Friday night Gross was there?
Never heard of anything like that, but I can imagine it happening.
Okay. And can you imagine Gross with his pointer finger, as he always did, pointing his finger at you?
Of course. Of course.
Yeah. And he apparently told Joey, stop it or else. And Joey shoved him.
Oh, I didn't know about that, no.
Yeah. That's what I was told by a former seminarian.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So, and we know Butch Mazur and Joey didn't like each other. He was there. And then I also heard, now, do you think he was killed in his office or do you think he was killed someplace else?
Your brother, you mean?
Yeah.
I think he was killed in that room at St. Lawrence.
Okay.
Where his desk was and everything.
Okay. Because
Don't you think that?
Well, I'm not sure because there's no blood splatter on the walls in his private quarters upstairs where the crime scene photos are.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, when Church Militant did the reenactment, Michael Archer, their forensic scientist, said that they brought him upstairs by gunpoint.
Really?
Yeah. Now,
but wait a minute. But wait, wasn't his desk and all his paperwork, was that downstairs or was that upstairs?
He had two offices. He had his office downstairs off the kitchen, where, like, Barb and Deb and all the office staff were downstairs. But then in his private quarters upstairs, he had his private office, which he didn't lock because it was right across from his bedroom. That's where he was found.
But which place was it where he had the desk that was locked that David LaPuma forced open?
That was upstairs.
Okay.
That was upstairs.
That little tidbit was edited by our very own Rachel O'Brien. Give us a quick sneak peek, because I know we've been lagging just a little bit, but we're going to make it up to you guys. Had a wild last couple of weeks. That'll be all explained in the bonus episode coming out later. But the way, and with such conviction that Art says David LaPuma forced open, it's pretty telling. Like, he knew that happened Where he got that information, we don't know. But there's a lot we don't know that seemingly Art Smith does know. And we can't thank Gina enough for her down and dirty, brave and bold investigative work. It's thorough, it's daring, and we really owe a lot of these first episodes to Gina. In this episode, we're going to take a deep dive into the first three visits Gina had with Art Smith on his deathbed.
The opinions expressed or views expressed are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily reflect or represent those of the host, sponsors, or podcast affiliates. It should be noted that this podcast should not be used in any legal capacity whatsoever, and all views represent opinions, not necessarily facts or evidence.
But which place was it where he had the desk that was locked that David LaPuma forced open?
That was upstairs.
So Gina, you noticed it in the moment when you were there, but it seems like Sue was like punched in the gut, like the wind was taken out of her sails when he says that. But she keeps going because she needs to get more information out of him.
So this is one of those comments that really made me raise an eyebrow and added it to the pile of things that were making me consider him a suspect, because nobody would say those exact words that LaPuma busted the drawer. Like, unless you were there, how would you know that? Who would say that out loud?
Yeah, it rolled off the tongue too quickly.
And with confidence and like nice and slowly, like make sure you hear this and really drink it in. You know, like LaPuma forced open. Like he was very crystal clear about it.
What was it like for you to hear him say that? Just be in the room and hear him say that.
I was really surprised because, like I said, when I went in there, this was the first day. This was the first interview. And I think I went there, how many recordings do I have? Six days, but then multiple answers, whatever. This was the first day. And this was some tea that he spilled. I was keeping track of all the little bits of tea that he would spill, and this was like glaring at me. And combine that with what he said about, Charlie Specht, and that he sent the threat in a letter downtown, like all these things. This was on day one. So, yeah, he definitely gave me the impression that he knew more than somebody that would just have looked on the internet.
So, how a right-handed person shoots himself in the back of the head on the left side, which apparently there's two gunshot wounds. How it's sitting in a recliner with his feet crossed. How do you do that?
Yeah.
You know?
All that part is all such a mystery.
Yeah. Yeah. And the gun's not in his hand. Or the gun isn't where it should be if he truly did shoot himself. And if he would have shot himself, why not shoot himself? But my brother wasn't, if Joey were to do that, I don't think how many people told us that if we knew that Father Joe was in trouble, we would have been knocking down the door.
Right.
So no one except the people at 795 Main Street who conjured up this story to suit their own needs know what really happened to Joey. Don't you think?
I'm sorry, I missed that last part you said. How many people at 795 what?
Main Street.
Yeah. Would
really know what happened to Joey. because they're the ones that did it.
And as we learned from last season, there's a boys' club within the Buffalo Diocese, a group of men who went to seminary together, who cover for each other, clean up their messes, and keep their mouths shut.
They're the ones that, whether it was LaPuma and Gross, if it was Malone, everyone at the chancery knew what really happened. And it wasn't a suicide.
That's a tremendous question. And I believe there's a lot of truth to it. But there's one other thing I was going to say. I don't know how they can get away with that, if that's in fact the truth. I don't know how they can get away with it when someone in that little group knows the truth of what actually happened.
Yeah. So if you were a betting man, who do you think it would be? Who would know?
Well, let me put it this way. I think that LaPuma would know the way that he treated him. And I know that LaPuma might want to try to deny it, but there's enough people around who know that they had a lot of animosity against each other. That would be one thing.
Right.
Second thing, a bishop has to protect his own back. And I believe that he was protecting David's back and protecting his own image by how he treated you and your dad.
Is it me, or does it seem like Art's guarding something? Like he knows more, and he's trying to lead Sue.
You know, sexual stuff that went on between him and Manziel that Joey knew about. So we won't go there.
Okay. But, I can see that, though. I can imagine that happening.
Well, I think we all could. Yeah, because David didn't get anywhere on his marriage. He got where he was because of what he did.
Right.
And that's not to be taken as a compliment in any shape or form.
Right.
Because you know what I'm saying.
Yep, I do.
So, one other thing that he said when Sue was talking about the topics blog. Now, the topics blog was, like, you know how you see, like, a news story on the internet and then there's comments below it? The Buffalo News, when they would post stories and people would comment below it, that would go into this topics blog, and that's what Sue was referring to when she was talking to him about this. And there's a letter that they sent, a blog post that's dated on January 16th, 2013, and it's posted by Anonymous. Okay, so in this is what Sue is talking to him about, and she's sort of telling him that the main storyline of this thing, but here it is. In somewhat of a rage, LaPuma, self-appointed bishop in charge, told him no about going to another church in Hamburg. Father Joe then asked LaPuma what he could do to change LaPuma's mind about him, and LaPuma told him he would think about it. The next day, LaPuma went to the rectory where Father Joe lived and brought a gun with him. He told Father Joe that he wanted him to kill someone for him, and Father Joe refused. LaPuma shot Father Joe instead. So this is what Sue is talking to my uncle about, and she says,
were you familiar? It was called Topics, the Diocese of Buffalo, and it was a blog on online, and it goes back quite a while. But when all this stuff started happening, and when Charlie was investigating, the former FBI agent took it down. But there were a lot of priests that would post on it, as well as some people from the chancery. Were you familiar with that blog at all?
but the Diocese of Buffalo, Sue told me, hired a former FBI agent to remove all these comments from the topics blog, and they're gone now, but Sue has printouts of them from, you know, prior. She had them printed before they got deleted. So this topics blog, I printed out, Sue sent it to me, I printed it out, and I brought it with me that day when we went to see him on 8/22. She had mentioned it to him on the first interview on 8/14, and he was like, I can see it happening that way. He was very like, yeah, that sounds, but this topics blog is bananas. Like, to think that this is real life is really kind of wild. So so on January 16th, 2013, so 3 months after Father Joe was murdered, Anonymous wrote, "The father is neither Father Anselm nor Father David. The father of the child is Father Yasek Mazur. Father Yasek also testified in court that he witnessed or knew of the murder of Father Joe Marino." So, yes, it's true. Father Marino did not commit suicide. He was part of a group who had banded together to try to help the victims of the Chancery vermin. Father Joe had asked to be allowed to live at St. Anthony of Padua in the city instead of going to Hamburg to live with his friend. In somewhat of a rage, La Puma, self-appointed bishop in charge, told him no. Father Joe then asked La Puma what he could do to change La Puma's mind about him, and La Puma told him he would think about it. The next day, La Puma went to the rectory where Father Joe lived and brought a gun with him. He told Father Joe that he wanted him to kill someone for him, and Father Joe refused. La Puma shot Father Joe instead. The visit of La Puma had been anticipated and was set up by Father Joe to nab La Puma at what he did best. However, the murder had not been anticipated. La Puma left and waited until the diocese was notified that Father Joe had, quote, killed himself. And then La Puma himself took the phone call, went to the scene that he had a short time before created. Yasek Mazur had the proof. He himself had previously been blackmailed by La Puma into bearing false witness against the rectory cook and was working on the Chancery vermin side in order to spare his young child. He was also receiving money from the benefactress to torment the cook. He needed the money to support his child. When the cook discovered that he was the father of the young child, she took mercy upon him and forgave him in order not to leave the child fatherless. He accepted her forgiveness and changed sides. He kept up the facade until the time came for him to, quote, out La Puma in court. That was last week. So that would have been January 7th, 8th, 9th-ish of 2013. That father of the young child.
What was I going to say? The blog. I remember there being a blog that you could go to.
Okay.
If you wanted to see the gossip that was going on.
And okay.
I maybe had looked at it maybe two or three times, but you know, there was so much garbage on it. I just didn't pay attention anymore.
Some of it, I actually took the, there's the one from that said that La Puma shot Joey.
Right.
I actually showed it to the former psychologist for the diocese long time ago. This is when it first happened. And she said it was too convoluted not to be true.
That's the one in your hand.
So read that one and let me know when I see you on Friday what you think of it.
And then she says, I talked to the former psychologist for the Diocese of Buffalo. I showed her that, and she said it was too convoluted not to be true.
This topics blog, man, I mean, it's a dicey situation. On one hand, it's a blog post on the internet. On the other hand, It's so finely detailed and intricately described that a psychologist that used to work for the diocese said that it was too convoluted not to be true. And as a theory, it does have a lot of details that seemingly play out with known truths that really make me wonder. Who wrote that? How did they know all of this? And we already know that many priests in the diocese were very active on this blog. This is pretty out there, but we have to consider it.
I would guess that he will now be able to leave the priesthood and provide for his family. Of course, it goes without saying that he jeopardized his own life in doing this and probably won't be able to be found. I believe that Father Anselm was bound by the seal of the confessional not to reveal what he knew. The same can be said by many of the priests of the diocese. They were sometimes under obedience to the bishop and other times under the seal of the confessional, and at times both simultaneously. They cannot discuss it, nor can they defend themselves. Father David B. did not father a child since he was in a, quote, different club. So that wild and crazy story about La Puma bringing a gun and asking Father Joe to kill somebody and Father Joe saying no and Father Joe anticipating La Puma, like the whole thing, it was very detailed. And he reads it and he's like, oh, I could see it happening like that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot you could debate about in here. It's all crazy, but he was more interested in who was the father of the baby. He didn't dispute any of the details about that day at all.
Who's the David B that did not father the child?
I was going to ask you that. I don't know. I don't know who that is. I don't know any of these priests that are mentioned except for La Puma.
Well, that Father Jossick.
Yeah.
And Father I thought that Father Anselm was the father of the baby, not Jossick.
So the father of the child that they're talking about is Father Jossick Mazur, okay? The reason why a child is brought up is because Father Jossick Mazur was brought to civil court for child support. And on the stand, he testified in court that he witnessed or knew of the murder of Father Joe Marino.
Question is, how come no one ever went back and investigated the church stairs, the rectory stairs, his room, the desk? Why was there no further investigation of that?
Well, the only thing I can say is that they didn't want the real reason out there.
But cops can't stop doing that, though. They have to
go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, once an investigation starts like that, you can't just stop it because you say you want it stopped.
But does the diocese have the power to do that?
Well, they've done it in the past.
Okay. I mean...
Now that's telling. He says it with such certainty. And I don't know what he's referring to, but they've done it in the past. They've just called for police investigations to stop. And in the city of Buffalo, they stop.
Art asks if Gina has shown this topic's blog, but something he refers to as a letter, to Charlie Specht. Charlie Specht had received intense threats as a journalist. If it happened to a priest, What's not to say it could happen to a journalist?
Have you shown this to Charlie Specht, this letter?
I don't think I have, only because Charlie had tried really hard, Father Art, to get Joey's story out. So he was in a conference in Florida, and he said, Sue, I have good news and I have bad news. He said, the good news is that there was another media outlet that was interested in pursuing Joey's story. Bad news is Channel 7 wouldn't spare him. And at the very end of his email to me, he said, you know, Sue, he said, it probably is a good thing. He said, after all, they killed a priest. What's preventing them from killing a reporter?
Say that last sentence again.
In his last email, he said, maybe this is a good thing because if they murdered a priest, what's preventing them from murdering a reporter?
Oh, boy. Oh, jeez.
Right?
Oh, my God. Yeah.
So with that, he sort of directly backed out, but, you know, he still tried to share Joey's story, and I will always be grateful.
So that first day that we were there on 8/14, my uncle had asked, Sue had asked my uncle about the topics blog, right? So he, at the time on the 14th, he's like, oh, I could see it happening that way or whatever. So on 8/22, which was my third time there, because there was one time in the middle on 8/17 that I went there and you spoke to him. Sue didn't, but you did. So this is the third trip there, and it'll make sense to you in a minute why that matters. So on 8/14, he brought up the topics blog or whatever. So then Sue sends it to me, and I print it out, and I hand it to him. So in the video, he's referring to it as a letter, but that's because he has like a piece of paper in his hand. But it was a topics blog post. So that topics blog is the comments section of the Buffalo News, essentially. It all gets stored into this blog kind of thing, and then there's sections that are about certain topics. And in particular, there's a section about the Diocese of Buffalo where the priests were very active on that, on the topics blog. Whenever there was a news article about anything to do with the diocese, they would start commenting on there. So I hand him the letter, and, you know, we talk for a little bit first, and then he takes the letter and puts his glasses on and he takes the time to read it. And while he's reading it, now this story is really bananas, right? And he doesn't say much, but he takes a little break and he says, when I finish this, I have a question about Yasek. And who is David B. that did not father the child? So he starts asking about it a little bit. And so the crazy thing about this topics blog thing is that theory that they presented, this topics blog claims that somebody had testified that Father Joe Marino was murdered, and they said that was testified to in court. So and it's the reason why it was in court was because this Father Yasek Mazur had a baby, and it was in like child court about that. It was a civil court. It wasn't canon law. It wasn't church court. So it claims that this priest had testified in a normal court of law that he knew about Father Joe Marino's murder. So anyway, he doesn't dispute any of the conversation about Father Joe Marino in that topics blog. But what he says at the end is very interesting. He says, did you show Charlie Specht this letter?
Have you shown this to Charlie Specht, this letter?
Sue tells him the whole story about how, well, Charlie tried really hard on Joey's case, but in the end, he was getting death threats, and he said, you know, if they killed a priest, what's preventing them from killing a reporter? So he sort of stepped away from the case.
Because he was in fear.
He was in danger, and somebody was arrested and charged and sent to prison for death threats against him. Somebody that worked at the Christ the King Seminary in East Aurora.
While Gina is interviewing her uncle Art Smith in the late summer of 2023, something is happening behind the scenes. Something that she doesn't discover until close to 9 months later.
Yeah, so there was one day I was driving to work and I brought my iPad with me, and I hadn't brought it with me in a really long time. I usually just use it at home. So it was in my car this particular time. Now, I may have gotten the same sort of pop-up on my phone at some point, but you know how you have like 50 text messages, it popped up, I might have just dismissed it. I'm not sure. However, my iPad told me that there was an AirTag, specifically an AirTag, traveling with me, and it showed me a map that it went from my house to the store where I work and then back to my house. And I told my husband, and he's like, no, I don't know what you're talking about. And he really thought I was, you know, it's an AirTag that's one of ours for the cats or the dogs, or, you know, he dismissed it, right? So, but I got it to make a noise. I got it to make that little beacon ping, and you could hear it in my car. So I would say a good, and I have all of this on video too, not all of it, but a lot of it. So it was in the front driver's side wheel well above my tire, like inside. So it took a good probably 2 to 3 hours total to locate it and then to get it out.
Uncovering a story about the diocese is extremely dangerous. But Gina, our other friend who will go unnamed, Sue, and so many others are willing to put their lives on the line because Joey put his life on the line and suffered the ultimate consequence.
Well, the other thing about Apple is it tells you if it's a known AirTag or not. And it clearly said this AirTag is unknown to you. Like, it's not attached to my Apple ID, so it's not for my dog or for my cats. So, And it's pinging and making noise, and it's in my car, like, clearly in my car. We're laying with my, you know, your ear on the hood and then your ear on the side of the car, and, like, all three of us were trying so hard to identify where in the car it was first, because we could hear it, but then needed to know exactly where. And then, there's an app called AirGuard, and we downloaded that app, which stayed connected to it much better and had the beacon noise more continuous than the Apple app did. The Apple app helped us find it, and then the AirGuard app helped us, like, get it out of the car. So I'm looking at this AirTag, and, you know, of course the serial number's on it, and you hold it up to your phone and it says the last four numbers of the phone number associated with the Apple ID that activated the AirTag. And then when I put the serial number into Apple's website, it tells you when the warranty expires on that device. And it told me that the warranty expires on 8/22/24. And Apple's warranty is 1 year. So if you reverse and go back 1 year, that means that Apple AirTag was activated on 8/22, which is a day specifically that I was there interviewing my uncle with Sue Marino on the phone. The other thing about it is after I took it to the police station, I think this was June, right around your car accident and right around when his car broken into and I mean, there was all these things like in that week or 2 week span that were really, really odd.
It was also in the same month in which I was in a near fatal car accident. Now, let me state this. I don't believe necessarily that my accident was caused by reporting on the diocese and Father Joe's mysterious death. A sudden hailstorm with golf ball size hail came on, and I feel I know that that was the cause. But then Sue, and our other friend, and Gina, who found the tag on her car the exact same week as my accident, started to make me wonder, were my brake lines cut?
The police station, and I don't know how they saw this or where they saw it or anything like that, because I did the same, holding the AirTag up to the phone and plugging it into this or that. So the officer comes in and says, well, it has the name Rachel.
So weird.
And I was like, Rachel? I didn't see Rachel anywhere. I saw the last four digits of the phone number. I saw the serial number, things like that. Nothing to do with Rachel. But they specifically said the name Rachel. And she said, well, what if I said it was Rachel Smith? Because she was like, do you know any Rachels? And I'm like, well, yes. And she said, well, what if I said it was Rachel Smith? And I'm like, well, that's my cousin. So it's very possible that one of my family members put it in there on my uncle's behalf or at his direction. That's a possibility that the name Rachel came from a family member. It's also
well,
a possibility.
What if I said it was Rachel Smith? If, like, it almost seems like she's trying to pry information. Like, what if I said it was Rachel Smith? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, I guess that could mean, like, okay, that could be your cousin Rachel.
Yeah, it was. I can send that audio to you because I did record it, but she says Smith as if she's just throwing that name in the mix.
Yeah, because it could just mean, like, okay, like, it's like Smith or Johnson.
Yes, know, like. Right. So then I said, you know, it could either be my cousin or Rachel from the podcast, because this is my, this 822, at the time, I don't think I even knew that it, I don't know, at the time at the police station, but I'm fast forward to right now. Mm-hmm. If you're looking at the times that I went to the hospital to talk to him, 814 was the first one.
Mm-hmm.
817 was the second one, and that was with you, with Rachel.
On the phone.
On the phone.
Yeah, yeah.
Then the third time I went there was possibly the time that the AirTag got put in, named Rachel. So to me, I have two theories because I still don't know who put the AirTag in. But my theories are it was my family member that put it in at my uncle's direction, or that somebody else put it in and put the name Rachel on it to look, this is about the fact that you brought Rachel and got her on the phone with him, you know, the last time you were here.
Honestly, I think both theories are plausible. And I'd like to say for the listeners, I wasn't in Buffalo at that time, but you've told me some stuff I'd like you to go into in a second, but like
all of us in Buffalo were very concerned and suspicious of that car accident. I'll tell you that right now. You meet anybody in our crew, or if there's somebody new that comes into the mix, your safety and like what you do to keep yourself safe, whether you're using burner phones or whatever, these are real conversations that we have every day, and we're just normal people, but that's who we're dealing with.
Until I had talked to my circle in Buffalo, I had never considered the possibility of my wreck being an act of violence against me. But then, our friend said, you need to check the brake lines. Do you think the brake lines were cut? But by this point, our truck had been taken away by a wrecking service from the insurance company, and I could not check the brake lines. And slowly, with all of the eerie coincidence, I guess there is a 15% possibility that creeps into my mind that believes maybe that could be possible. It was the same week, for Christ's sake. And Gina reminds me, they are in every corner of the planet, and they have more money than God. And so I say to Gina, if you believe it's possible, possible they've killed whistleblowers, tracked down journalists, and are now tracking you, how are you not afraid?
I'm not saying that I'm not. I'm well aware of the danger. I'm trying to uncover or trying to expose a murder. I mean, obviously, I know they're capable of it. I don't know. I don't know what to say about where it doesn't feel like courage to me. I just feel like I'm over this. Like, our city is screwed. Our city is in a constitutional crisis, and nobody, I can't afford to be quiet about it anymore. I watched my uncle for 50 years abuse a laundry list of people and watched people die. I can't be quiet about it anymore. Shame on me if I don't speak up. That's how I look at it. And if this puts my life at risk, well, my brother's a cop. My sister-in-law is a cop. They're putting their lives at risk. It's no different. My dad was in the army. He fought in Vietnam. He put his life at risk. It was no different. Like, it's human nature.
I guess one of the things I would say is don't believe or don't give up thinking this is the end of the story. That would be one. I don't think you can fight the church, you know, even though it is maybe not telling you the truth. I don't think you can fight the church because the church is a monster when it comes to its authority and its power. And unfortunately, little guys, like little bishops, have all that power and have all that authorities, so you might not be able to go against them.
Thank you guys so much for listening and for your support. Let's get justice for Father Joe and all the other victims of the Buffalo Diocese. And if you have any tips, please email them to deadlybflotips@gmail.com. That's deadlybflotips@gmail.com.